Right, just going to do a little introduction. First thing, it's good to see a small but quality audience here. This is the first event of, I think, 14 events we're putting on in the next 10 days. As part of, it's kind of, we have a Bristol Rally History Week in October and November. This is kind of our six-monthly kind of smaller group of events which we're putting on. This year we decided to look at commons, and when we discussed talking about the commons, it came up in a group that we asked a few people in the pub, actually, you know, what do you think about the commons? And most people thought that we were talking about House of Commons. So we decided to call the event Down with the Fences, The Struggle for the Global Commons, which is a long title, as Venue said, if you saw the article last week. It's a long title, but we're trying to make it clear to everybody what the subject of the talks is about. And they're highly relevant at the moment. And as over the period we've been organising since Christmas, it's become more and more relevant in Bristol, in particular with issues about gentrification. There's quite a few of the events are kind of directed towards those issues and how they affect Bristolians. But they're also obviously connections across the world, as we would argue that the last 20 years in particular has been a wave of new enclosures. So that's kind of where these events are coming from. We're going to try and look at some of the aspects of those. A year and a half ago, when we did our first Rally History Week, Peter kindly came over from the States and did a talk on the Magna Carta, which you just finished, I think, at that time, the book, Magna Carta, Liberties and Commons for All. It was an excellent talk, so we've kind of thought that as the book got published this year, I think in February the 1st, that it would be really great to bring him back, not only to talk about the Magna Carta tonight, but also to do some other talks. So very pleased to have Pete here tonight. When I introduced him at the last time Pete was here, I kind of ran through some of the books he's produced and the importance in those books for us in Bristol, the Bristol Radical History Group. The reason those books are important is that basically one of them inspired all of the events we've done. We've done over 50 events now in the last year and a half, 2 years. That book was the Many-Headed Hydra, which was certainly extremely important in motivating us to look at Bristol, not only from the perspective of aspects such as the commons or, you know, working class struggles, but also to look at Bristol as a port and its relationship to the Atlantic trading economy. So obviously lots of issues around slavery and other things that we've brought up over the last couple of years. So the Many-Headed Hydra was very, very important to us. I also mentioned a couple of other books he's produced, which I think are really great. One of them is called The London Hanged, and, which is about the transition from... I'm laughing because... we'll see in a minute. But The London Hanged, great book, about the transition from a non-wage economy to a wage economy. And as I said at the time, you know, some people might think that's boring, but I thought it was a brilliant book because it was not only able to explain that process through various perspectives, but also was able to do it in a way that was very, very understandable and also exciting in the way that he wrote that book. At the time, I said it, you know, people might think that's boring. Peter stood up and said, boring, 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 and actually, interesting, interesting, interesting. So I would absolutely recommend those two books, The London Hanged and The Many-Headed Hydra, which Peter co-wrote with Marcus Rediker. Very, very important books in historical sense, but also very important in the way that they've inspired us. The Magna Carta book, which I haven't read yet, and I'm sure Peter's going to talk about tonight, has just come out, and I would, from what I've seen of it, I've flipped through already, I'm pretty impressed, so... I'm not going to say a lot more, but just to say, you should give him a little ripple of applause.
Yeah, thank you. It's, Roger, it's good to be back in such an interesting place among such interesting people who write such interesting pamphlets and put on such interesting presentations. And I would like to... give us some food for thought before the evening's out. Yeah. But I think I'll go on the up on the stage. Yeah. right down there. It's nice. It's warm. But I think I also want to show off my shirt, which I wore for the occasion. It's from Oaxaca in Mexico. And I've learned a lot from the people in Oaxaca and from the people of that region of the Western Hemisphere, that region of the Americas. I myself am from the Great Lakes region of North America, near Detroit. I work in Toledo and teach at Ann Arbor. And I'm a professional historian and a teacher. Before going any further, you know, I wanted to wish everybody Happy May Day.
Hey.
And I think in a day or two I'll have a chance to talk a little bit about the history of May Day and what it has meant and continues to mean to us in North America, and also some of the what it might mean in other parts of the world, especially yours, especially England. And I'm going, I should let you know that though I work in North America and I spent most of my life there, as a child I lived in London. And then I took my advanced work as a historian, as a scholar, at the University of Warwick. I had left Columbia University, which I think 40 years ago this week, we had a strike and a sit-in. And Edward Thompson, the noted historian, was collecting a group from around the world to come to England and work with him, and I was one of them. So I finished my professional training as a historian in England. I mention this to you because sometimes I'm not sure whether I feel at home there or here. I have a kind of mixed up consciousness about that, and from a early on the pressure was, what are you? Are you an American or are you English? And I have an American passport, if that, you know, whatever that means. The problem came up again when with Magna Carta. Magna Carta means one thing in North America and it perhaps means something else here. Rather than try to sort through the subject, you know, through those different lenses, if you follow me, I just can say what I think, you know, and not worry about whether it's English or whether it's American. Do you follow me? I'm asking for your help on this. I'm asking for your permission to speak on a subject which I know in the past has been very important in this part of the world. And I'm speaking about it because it's also been important in the North American part of the world. Yeah. I'd like to thank Roger and Rich, who's going to help me. I have a few pictures to show you tonight about Magna Carta, both here in England and in India and in the United States. But I think it would be best if I spoke for a while before we, you know, looked at the slides and gave our eyes a treat and a rest. But among those slides is a slide from India, from Delhi. And I mention that because Rich took them, and he's helping me out with the pictures. But I also, before I went much further, I want to extend my thanks to the Bristol crowd, that has put together four such weeks and perhaps 70 events. To thank them very much. The book that I wrote, the Magna Carta Manifesto, is very much a product and has been nurtured by the Bristol group. Bristol looks to the west across the ocean, and this comes back, and I was very happy to make a presentation of it to the Bristol Radical History Group. And looking over this week, you know, there's Kett's Rebellion, there's a talk on that, there's a talks on football, talks on many subjects, including that are dear to me and dear to this book, that I think, I hope, the information and the knowledge that I try to offer you tonight, you know, will help prepare us for the oncoming workshops. One of these is, I come from also a particular political tradition in North America. And my comrades there include George Kafensis, who is speaking on Sunday. He's at the University of Southern Maine. He's speaking on John Locke and Clift Coins. He's also down for speaking on new enclosures. And you don't need me to tell people in England that what enclosures were, or what. But those of us outside of England were beginning to think of enclosures, amplifying the term, to have to do with the restraint, the constriction of many other activities, but always based on the enclosure of land, which I think is famous to all English people. George and I were discussing this thing of enclosure, and now coming from America, we were trying to summon up on the internet the Bushvilles that we're beginning to call them. You know, people are losing their houses and going to live in tents, trying to put the tents up in a place to supply for a roof to protect them from the rain. I guess the whole world knows about this from Katrina, but it's now happening in other parts of America. We say Bushville because it reminds us of the Hoovervilles that were established at the time of the Great Depression, you know, early in the 20th century, in 1930, 31, and 32, when people were thrown out, when their living space was enclosed. And there, the banks foreclosed on them. So this is a discussion that is very current to us, and George and I began talking about it this afternoon. And I hope very much that the themes that we raised, he will continue, and that what I have to say about Magna Carta can help us in the future begin to solve the problems of our subsistence, which includes a roof over our heads. Yeah. Yeah, the book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, poses a problem to me because early on, as a young man coming to try to understand the world in the time of early 1960s, we were in North America, we were very earnest in the civil rights movement about how should we spend our lives, to what should we commit ourselves. And there was a kind of deep moralism that came out of the civil rights movement in the American South and also in the American North. And young people of my generation were affected by that. So we were always thinking, like, what is to be done? Why? But when we say the civil rights movement, those even with a simplest understanding of that know that it meant breaking the law. Know that, and nowadays I think the whole world knows, because both Mahatma Gandhi and M.L. King have become more or less world icons. But they, at least in North America, they were not that way in 1960, 61, 62, 63. So this notion of moral commitment and breaking the law were very closely tied with one another. And we began to think, what is the law? Who makes the law? What is legislation? And how should it be interpreted? And who should interpret it? The individual conscience or the Supreme Court? You know, Scalia and Rehnquist, if I can use
make references to the American Supreme Court and the judicial system. It was out, so then by the time of the late 60s, after the great assassinations, the discussion about law advanced and changed quite a bit. And we began young activists, young, if I can use that word, young militants, young people in direct action, began to scorn the law. We began to think of the law as being a liberal. Yeah, that's good to hear. Start some interaction. Thank you. It's just, I hope your drink wasn't spilled. I intend to speak, I should say right away, for somewhere between half an hour and an hour. And then Roger suggests that we have a break, you know, to replenish our drinks. But if you wish to step out for another reason, I would not be offended. And then to see how the discussion goes. It's from those discussions about the law that, you know, I came to Warwick and we began to talk about the law. And Albion's Fatal Tree and the London Hanged all had to do partly with working class views of the law and the law as a class apparatus. That was the vibe at that time. And it pretty much remained that way until, 1994 is very important, but I want to bring it right up to 9/11, 2001. You remember when some unknown, unidentified criminals hijacked airplanes and attacked the great architecture of finance capitalism in the United States. But of course, finance capitalism, also the Twin Towers of Manhattan, but it also involves many workers. So it was an attack on thousands of our fellow workers in New York, New York City. And I know for you in Britain that people all over the world regard themselves as New Yorkers, you know, so it's not a particular, you know, national thing. And many were shocked by this attack. And there was about 4 days, you know, when there was a lot of, when it was a very teachable moment, about 4 or 5 days of almost a national, I won't say mourning, but curiosity, open-minded, you know, what's happened, why? It's really, and then the state moved in, you know, and began to mold the response. And this was, was especially devastating for us. Now I'm using a narrower us, because that summer we tried to participate in two really important discussions, worldwide discussions. One was that another world is possible, and that discussion was kind of brought to a sharp end in Genoa in July 2001 with the assassination of the young Italian trade unionist. What was his name?
Carlo Giuliani.
What?
Carlo Giuliani.
That was in July. And then in late August and early September, there was another very important event that affected us all on how to make another world. But this was not looking to the future, but was looking to the past. And you remember, this was the discussion of reparations that took place in South Africa, in Durban, South Africa. And you remember the United States officially walked out of that the week before the 9/11 attacks. And they walked out, the United States walked out on grounds very closely tied to its military relationship with the State of Israel. You know, it had to do with Palestine and Zionism, that walkout. So these were like three big issues, you know, one having to do with racism and reparations to Africa for the centuries of the slave trade upon which, as Frantz Fanon had taught us, the wealth of the West was based, if you needed a teacher of that kind. So when those 4 days happened of grieving, we were wondering how to advance the discussion of reparation, you know, or how to, what other world was possible. And when Bush began, announced an endless war of terror. And our older comrades in the United States, like Marty Glaberman, told us in November of 2001 at a meeting we had in the Midwest that the single greatest purveyor of terrorism in the world was the United States government itself. And this was a very bracing reminder of not only how the rest of the world sees the United States, but how, as we in the United States, what our duty was to become, what our duty was, how to deal with this great engine of world terrorism. So in October 2001, when President Bush gives his talk, remember, at the United States Congress, the representative assembly, senators and representatives, Prime Minister Blair at the time was there in the balcony with his lovely wife. There were many judges and generals and admirals who were also there to listen to how the United States was going to react. And we know pretty much how it reacted, and it was during that reaction that I began to think again about the law, and especially about Magna Carta, because we hadn't been doing our job, us militants, us activists, or us English history professors. I didn't know what Magna Carta was. I didn't know what it said. I hadn't been brought up being taught what it was. Did I say I thought it was a white man bourgeois liberal document? You know, that was the rather ignorant views that we had had. And so when we needed it, because Bush began to lock up people without, thousands of people without a trial, he began to send people around the world for the purposes of torture. And we know now this is not an exaggeration. This is not rhetorical radicalism. So habeas corpus, trial by jury, prohibition of torture, due process of law, all of these principles of law had an origin, I was to learn, in Magna Carta. Magna Carta itself, you know, is a big charter with 63 chapters. You learned this, but we didn't learn it. And this 39th chapter has been interpreted through centuries to produce those four principles of law that I just mentioned, that were so quickly dismissed as if they didn't exist. Habeas corpus, prohibition of torture, trial by jury, due process of law. The trial by jury one I'd like to conclude with tonight, if I have the wit, or if you can help me. You know, if I don't mention it in our talk, I hope it can come up at some point in our discussion. I would like to, because I think I've been thinking about it, and I think we all need to think about it. That's trial by jury. Okay, I think I'm beginning to warm to the subject. But it is chilling. It was chilling. And it remains so. In fact, it might be worse. Let's look at a few pictures, all right? And then we'll move. So I had to go find out about Magna Carta, as I said. Can you see all right?
I can see you.
Well, that's good. Okay. Well, you can see my Oaxaca shirt, I hope. The Oaxaca shirt and this book are very closely related. They're very closely related. In fact, it should remind us, I can tell you, this book really is a mistake. It's a mistake born of Anglo-American ignorance. Because in 1994, when the Zapatistas came to view, opposing the constitution that suppressed the indigenous people of the Americas, when it came to view to oppose the North American Free Trade Association, or neoliberalism, because my comrades had gone, were to go to the Encuentro, the first Encuentro, an international assembly for the restoration of humanity and against neoliberalism, there in the jungles of Chiapas, I paid attention to what they said, but I could only do so in English. And Subcomandante Marcos appealed to the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, and he appealed to other such instruments, including Magna Carta. And I thought, hello, I want to go to that. Why is an indigenous American referring to Magna Carta? And I, as a Anglo-American English history professor, don't even know what it's about. And I felt kind of ashamed. Well, it turns out he wasn't referring to the medieval charter signed and, or acceded to by John in June 1215. But in the Spanish language, the Constitution of Mexico, they call Magna Carta. And they don't translate it. So that's how I got confused. Do you follow me? Semantics, a translation problem. The translation problem is a border problem. The border problem, though, works two ways. Because in the semantics, there's a surprise. Before that neoliberal NAFTA could be passed, and all the big juggernauts, you know, of commodities roar across the border both ways, and before wage relations could be competing against one another, before the human beings who were lost their subsistence in Mexico made their way north illegally into North America, before any of that could happen, the United States demanded of the Mexican government that that constitution be changed and its Article 27 be voided. And the Article 27 of the Mexican Constitution established the ejido. The ejido is the common lands of the village. Remember, the Mexican people, Zapata and Pancho Villa, demanded a constitution for land for the peasants, land for the workers. And that's why there's the sickle, you know, and the hammer and sickle thing. It's for such people as those who are demanding ejido. And they'd won it in their Magna Carta. But the American government required that to be voided. That's why I wear this shirt, you know, with the Magna Carta, because there's a border issue here, and now we're in a new situation. It's not the Mexican Constitution anymore, and it's not 2001 either. You know, there are people all over the world, as you know, in Oaxaca and Chiapas, who are thinking about constitutions, thinking about law. There are people in Bolivia trying to make a law. People in Ecuador who are saying, don't touch the oil under the ground. Don't touch it. There are people in Venezuela who are saying, oh, this oil belongs to all of us, and we will have oil swaps around the world. And they're thinking both of oil and of constitutions. This is happening. And I didn't get to the invasion of Iraq, but no sweat. In Iraq, people are thinking about constitutions and oil. And I'm saying to myself, in America, why aren't we thinking about constitutions and oil? Why aren't we thinking about that? I mean, in Britain, you are, because of the strike. And I don't know yet the terms of the discussion. But this is something that we need to do. You know, the planetary resources must become, we must think constitutionally about them. This was the discussion we were having at Midnight Gnosis and had been having for quite a long time. And now, you know, from other parts of the world, it's coming not to a head so much, but it's coming to our notice again. So I was on my way to South Africa and had a time to change. This is the free association, Raj. And I had a time to change planes, you know, a layover in Heathrow. And I thought, well, I'll catch me a bus and I'll go out to Windsor. And there I'll catch another bus or hitch a ride over to Runnymede. You know, where the meadow on the River Thames, where this Magna Carta was acceded to back in 1215, in June 15th to 17th, it took them a lot of days to do it, where these great 63 chapters occurred. And, you know, isn't it lovely? To me, coming from North America, you know, this is a tourist picture. I took it, thank you. It's a tourist picture of what we, you know, you think of the green and pleasant land. And there in the middle is a rotunda. And let's see if we can have another. Oh, in the middle of the rotunda is that star. Isn't that? The star is that, and does it have any semiotic meaning to you? It does to me and George. It is a symbol of that was on World War II airplanes of the United States. It's the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force. You know, it's like occupying Runnymede. And the American Bar Association, that the organization of lawyers in America and judges, they spent some money to build that rotunda, and they put in the middle of it this plinth, you know, right there, to commemorate Magna Carta, symbol of freedom under law. That's the same year that in North America we put "In God We Trust" on the money. That's what else did they do? That's the same year in North America that Eisenhower changed May Day to Law Day. It's the year that they inverted the meaning of Magna Carta. Perhaps you thought it was the king who was under law. Perhaps that's what you thought Magna Carta was about from chapter 39. But when the Americans took over Runnymede, they did a job on the symbols of Runnymede as thoroughly as they did on the Mexican Constitution. Do you follow me? They changed the meaning. That was the surprise. That was the thing. Sorry?
Was that not the time to switch it to this one?
I don't know, I'm just having some interaction. So to me it was shocking. You know, I went to Chicago to go to the American Bar Association headquarters to see if I could see whether the CIA was behind this or not. But, you know, on that kind of thing, you need to have an in. They need to be sure who you are. And frankly, Raj, you know, the work that I've done over the years, you know, there's some very good scholars and archivists at the American Bar Association. You know, they knew where I was coming from, and they showed me some magazines. They were very helpful with what they could. But as for private correspondence of Ryan, who was the Eisenhower's advisor and who was responsible for those three changes that I mentioned, I couldn't get any of that correspondence. And, you know, I don't know. So I'm not saying here to the recording machine or to you that the CIA was responsible for this. But I will say that you go in there to this little enclosure, and then can we see the next slide, the next picture? You go into the enclosure and you look out beyond the fences. So I'm putting this fence up here as a reminder of our conference theme, Down with the Fences. And I'm doing so for a couple reasons. First, you know, just on the other side of this enclosure, it's a four-way enclosure, and it's actually not here where I'm pointing, it's over on one of the other things. And if any of you are interested in exactly where it is, I can draw a map afterwards. But the U.S. Army Well, they have an oak tree put it planted there by Queen Elizabeth. They got an oak tree planted by Nehru. They got an oak tree plant several many oak trees. There's a lot of like druidical, you know, power stuff with oak. But what I wanted to get to was the dirt. The U.S. Secretary of the Army went to Jamestown, Virginia, where the first English settlement colonizing America occurred, and got a pail of dirt, he says, and took it over here and stuck it in the soil. And this is like, this is weird. You know? It's a weird, because dirt's just made by worms. You know, it's not made by Americans or English or, you know, Native Americans. It's just dirt. You know, it's good at this time of year and for things to grow. But this sort of symbolism that's going on here, it's really caused me to stop and think a little bit about the magic of the ruling class. You follow me? They're not quite... Yeah, let's move on. Ah, no. I show this picture. Yeah, let's keep this picture up. And I want to go back a minute, to step back a little bit in my talk, and go back to 2001, when Bush gave that speech. Remember, I had Blair up in the balcony, and the whole brass, and the representatives in front. And he says that we must defend our freedoms. And he said we must defend the freedom of speech. You know, and I thought, I'm listening to the guy. And I'm saying, yeah, that's true, we must. You know, I'm not being mean to him. Do you know what I mean? Then he said, we must defend our freedom of religion. I'm going, okay, good. And then, you know, and I'm waiting. You know, what are the other freedoms that we're defending? But that's it. And I'm watching TV, and I'm looking around as the camera pans up to Blair, down to these soldiers in the front row. You know, I'm saying, hey, somebody stand up and remind the man. There are four freedoms. You know, if he's talking to the Anglo-American Alliance, anyone over 60 years old knows that that war was fought for four freedoms. Freedom of speech, yeah, that was the Atlantic Charter. In January 6, 1941, in the midst of the Battle of Britain, Franklin Roosevelt says, we are fighting for the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and then the two from freedoms, freedom from fear and freedom from want. And why isn't one of those soldiers or Blair or some other veteran standing up and reminding him? And it's because he didn't learn it, he didn't know it, and he didn't want to. The neoconservatives behind him, I'm speaking of our colleagues like Alan Bloom of Cornell, who wrote The American Mind, or Gertrude Himmelfarb, of whatever university she's from, who's written much about it. She loves upper-class English life. She wrote dozens of books. So I looked at their books. They never talk about the free-born Englishman or the Magna Carta. You look in their indexes, there's no Magna Carta. Mm. Oh, my gosh. You mean it wasn't a bourgeois liberal white man's thing. Do you follow? And Bush didn't know. The whole trick they're doing in North America about English history is wrong. Completely wrong. From the Supreme Court through all of it. You can see I got excited. That was the State of the Union address. He announced those four freedoms. And I thought, man, history... He's not only forgotten, but history right in front of our eyes is being rewritten. As if World War II were fought for the two freedoms. You know? I was burned. 2 weeks later, on the 20th of January, Franklin Roosevelt comes up for his third inaugural. I don't know what was happening to Bristol at that time, or to Liverpool, or to the different parts of London, or to Coventry. I've got to go look up those dates, you know, for the different bombing campaigns and what
what English people, how people were coping. Because I know they were coping with commoning, for sure. That whole air raid thing was commoning, right? I mean, that down into the tubes, in London anyway. I know that Anaron Bevan, when he wasn't working, was out on his allotment. This is 1940, you know, September, October. You know, say, call it social democracy if you want. Call it, you know, see the limitations. But 1940, 1941 is an emergency. And I'm thinking, we're in an emergency. And I'm trying to wonder, Steve, how did they handle the emergency? What can we learn from them? January 20th, 1941, his third inaugural, Franklin Roosevelt saying that the democratic aspiration is no mere recent phase in human history. It's ancient. It is human history. It blazed anew in the Middle Ages, and it was written in the Magna Carta. So I thought, man, okay, we're on the right track. We need to talk about Magna Carta again from many different directions. We need this knowledge. We have a great long past behind us. It's been recognized before. And here's what I found out, man. Here's what I found out. Magna Carta, King John, you know, he must have had his fingers crossed or something, but he didn't mean it. The Civil War resumed right away. The Pope was on his side. The Pope, meanwhile, is getting the Fifth Lateran Council. You know, I'm taking you now to the Middle Ages, 1215. I'm taking you to the time of the formation of centralized monarchs. I'm taking you to the formation of the state. I'm taking you to the formation of the Catholic Church as a main development institutional organization of repression and land grab throughout Europe. Throughout Europe, what that means is the dispossession of the peasantry. I'm taking you to the time of official terrorism and the foundation of the Inquisition. I'm taking you to official anti-Semitism when the Yellow Star was developed at the Fifth Lateran Council. This is 1215. I'm taking you to the time of globalization for the competition of commodities and money in the Mediterranean, which, as you know, is a conflict between, quote, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Like, that's the framework for 1215. And within it, there's revolts of the working class and the working people of Europe, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, that results with the Albigensian Crusade. That's where I wanted to take us. But King John gets off. Luckily, he died in October. The story of his death is amusing, but I will not indulge myself with it right now. It's a suicide bombing. It's a blowback of biopiracy. And it's from Palestine. How he died. He's with his retainers. He's crossing the Wash over there in Lincolnshire, right? The tide comes up. The Wash takes all his baggage away, and he gets his clothes wet. He goes to the nearest abbey, church. Mav? He didn't say, may I come in? He said, I don't know what he said. What?
I'm King John. Let me in, I'm King John. I've got my clothes on.
Got no clothes on? No. We had some clothes on. The story I'm telling you comes from William Morris. And Morris learned it from a 14th century document. They let him in. He gets dry clothes. He wants dinner. How much was this bread? It was 12 pence. Oh, no, he said, how much was this penny loaf? And he said, well, before I'm done, it'll be 12 pence. And there was a monk in the back, a young youngster, who thought, that his time had come.
said, "Sir, can I get you a sweet?" And John said, "Yes." The monk went out into the orchard and plucked ripe plums. He removed the pit and inserted venom. And he brought them to the king. "King, a plum brought back by our crusaders from the Holy Land." King said, "You eat first, monk." The monk picked a plum and ate it. And the king observed him and took a plum himself and ate it. The monk turned blue, fell down, and perished before King John's eyes. And then the same thing happened with King John. May he rest in peace. That's the story. You see the blowback. You see the suicide bombing. You see the nobility of this young man of God. Well, the Civil War resumed in England. The French king, Louis, young Louis, was over here. And the Civil War came to an end a year later, and that Treaty of Kingston and the River Thames in 1217 was signed to put the French back, and the Civil War once again. But the charter was lost. I said, "Where is the charter?" Okay, the charter is produced, but now they changed it. They changed chapter 7. And chapter 7 says, "The widow shall have her reasonable estovers in the common." Great, I thought. Something happened, now we got communism. Because it had the word common in it. And I thought, oh boy, what do they mean by common? This is before privatization. And anyway, what are estovers? I didn't know these things. Did you want to know when this was? 1217. It was on September 11th, 1217. So when I found this out, in my own superstition, as a historian, you know, we love dates, I thought, oh, this could be a clue. So I looked up estovers, and estovers refers to, is Latin, Sir Edward Cook, you know, the man of the English, the jurist before the English Revolution, the English Civil War, defined estovers as house boot, plow boot, fuel boot, hedge boot. The widow can go into the forest commons and take wood for the purposes of fuel, for the purposes of her roof, for building, for the purpose of tools, for the purposes of food. And now, I'm thinking, oh, here's a part of Magna Carta that's been lost. They found it on the 11th of September, 1217. What is the relationship between survival and subsistence to the tyrannies that we just are living through? The preemptive war, grabbing other people's resources, the habeas corpus, throwing people in jail without saying why. The torture, destroying people and making them believe they were drowning all around the world, putting them in stress position for a long time, denying them their knowledge of their children, denying them knowledge of their mothers and fathers, taking them from communities. What is the relationship between these? We have a lot to learn from feudalism. I'm going to stop being one of those bourgeois historians who say, in a Marxist guise, who says that everything is progress. It's about time we began thinking these things through and reconstituting ourselves. And the Magna Carta can help us reconstitute ourselves in a way that the U.S. Constitution cannot. I'm not saying we throw it out. But if the U.S. Constitution includes the four freedoms of Franklin Roosevelt, that can be a start. What's the relationship between estovers and freedom from want? Woody Guthrie had a theory. Carlos Bulasan had a theory. I'm talking about the 1940s now. Woody Guthrie said, oh. When there shall be no want among you, because you'll own everything in common. This phrase, owning everything in common, it doesn't go back to Karl Marx. It goes back to St. Paul in the book of Acts in the Bible. You know, there are many sources. It's Magna Carta. There are many sources of anti-privatization, of having things in common. You see, what's happening to me is I'm trying to educate myself out of Cold Warism, you know, that we had been bred to, you know, in the era that I grew up, communism versus capitalism, America versus the Soviet Union. And this Magna Carta thinking is helping me. Gracchus Babeuf in France, William Thompson in Ireland, Karl Marx in Germany, they understand that the practice of commoning is a people's practice of poor people for subsistence. They develop their own theories of communism based on that experience. That's the theme. And it's up to us to recover that experience, those centuries. And this is partly what this book does, but I think many people must do it. It's the social history project, partly. What role has custom played? What role has neighborhood played? What role has anti-enclosure played? What role has free travel played? These are all principles of Magna Carta. Because not only with that emendation of Chapter 7 that I mentioned, the widow's reasonable estovers to the common, there was another charter that was found on the 11th of September, 1217. And that's the Charter of the Forest. And that introduces a whole slew of medieval terms that I never took in college because, first, we didn't live in England. I didn't need to know it. Second, it was medieval. I was supposed to know Latin. Third, it seemed to be backward and of no use. Things like panage, to be able to put your pig into the forest. But now, in 2001, these terms are having a new meaning to me because I'm thinking of the women who cursed the men by showing their bare bottoms or showing their genitalia. You know, when the men in the Niger River Delta made deals with those who were polluting the swamps and the mangrove commons. You know this, four years ago, 2003, and in Kenya now, this form of shaming with the destruction of common lands, because it's not just lands that are being expropriated, but it's human relationships that are being destroyed with the process of privatizing the commons. It's not an architectural problem. I was thinking of development, you know, in this area. It's a human problem of social relations. As someone was saying, it's our culture, as a graffiti said, it's our cultural assets. It's our social assets. And the social assets of the common is a place where women are not expropriated. Where the role of women in the commons, historically and in the world today, is not one of submission to the patriarchal wage. But it's an independent way of standing. It's a material basis of independence and autonomy. So Woody Guthrie, Carlos Bulasan, I was telling George, I was asking George, you know who Carlos Bulasan? No, he didn't. I didn't either until like 2 weeks ago. I'd never heard of him. But he was expropriated, you know, from his lands in the Philippines in like 1913, 1914. Has to make his way to the state of Washington, you know, in the 30s, 1931, where he joins what I think the whole world knows somewhat about, is the condition of agricultural workers in one of the richest places of the world for fruits, vegetables, berries. You know, that's a California. And he had to live the life, you know, of a pimp, a robber. He was an agricultural migrant worker. He wrote a book called America is in the Heart. I'd never heard of it until a young Filipina a scholar told me about it and asked me whether I'd read it or not, and I hadn't. Carlos Bulacan wrote an essay in the Saturday Evening Post. This is like a big newspaper they had, a magazine back in the 1940s, on what does the freedom of want mean? Because all kinds of propaganda were over those four freedoms. You know, we don't know these freedoms naturally. We have to be taught them. You know, stamps have to be named after them, right? So you can collect them if you're a stamp collector. Or posters have to be made that you see in the shops when you go to the shop. What are the four freedoms? And for those who want to read a bit, there's the magazine. And they, Carlos Bulacan, this agricultural worker, wrote the meaning of freedom from want. And he didn't tie it with Magna Carta. He didn't tie it with, you know, widows estovers. But he tied it in what are we going to become? What? And he wrote he wrote, we are the men and women reading books. Wow, it's a different era, isn't it? Searching in the pages of history for the lost world. The key to the mystery of living peace, imperishable joy. We are the factory hands, the field hands, mill hands everywhere, molding, creating, building structures, forging ahead. You know, this is the way they spoke. This is the way they thought in 1940, 41, 42, 43, during that emergency. If you want to know what we are, he wrote in the Saturday Evening Post, we are revolution. And this is how freedom from want was being expressed at that time. Isn't it something? To me, it's just very moving, you know, that the Asia, the other side of the world, is telling, quote, the richest capitalist country in the world what freedom from want is. This isn't consumerism, right? It's a different era. It really made a big impact on me. It's been well over the time, hasn't it, Raj? You don't have a timepiece, but I do. Shall we have a look at a few more pictures? Yeah. And then if anything occurs to me, I'll say it, and then we can have a break. Yeah. I was in Delhi. There's Chitra Joshi over there. And Mangalik, Mukul Mangalik, is standing up. The day before I was leaving Delhi, they wanted to take me to Humayun's tomb, where, the dome and the arch was first developed in India before it moved west to Persia and then to the Byzantium, you know, and then to St. Paul's and so on. But that part of the country. And as we were there, this young man and senior woman were on their bicycle with their load of wood, and it fell over. So we, everybody except me, as you can see, I'm busy with a camera, leapt to the aid, you know, to put back on the... This is Estovers. 40% of the meals in Delhi are prepared by wood fires from wood that is gathered around. I don't know the ins and outs of it. But this, to me, this is the world today. So it reminds me, it's not medieval. Though, of course, it's a hydrocarbon energy source. And to my thinking, when I talk about Estovers, I think immediately of oil and petroleum and Iraq. Do you follow me? It's hydrocarbon energy that enables us to survive, to subsist. This is what we see. Like you might say, this could be the gas pump or the petrol pump, you know, for that. I do want to take this far. I want to take this as far as it can go. Let's see the next one. These are Estovers, huh? Okay, this is in Cleveland, which is one part of the Rust Belt of the U.S., a steel city on a lake where coal and iron ore meet. 1913. They're on strike. Their courthouse, the sailors are on strike. The Wobblies are active.
What are Wobblies?
Good question. Thank you. Wobblies. wobblers. That's what I thought. Wobblers. No one quite knows where the name comes from. They're IWW workers. They're industrial workers of the world. It was an international movement of working people in the early 20th century, with a lot of continuity going forward. This mural, it's a bit anti-Semitic, a bit Orientalist in its depiction of King John. And it's a bit, it has in writing, and of course the kings at that time did not write. They hired us clerks, us professors, to do the writing for them. But you can see it's the church and the state acceding to Magna Carta in this lunette. It's one half of a mural. It was put up in 1913. The guy who did it is named Frank Brangwyn. And he was from, I was going to say he's from Wales, but it's not true. His name sounds like it. He was born in Belgium. He came to London in the 1880s. And his parents couldn't make do, and they were evicted. And Frank Brangwyn became an orphan in the streets. William Morris, quote, discovered him. And he went to work in the Morris & Co.'s studios. Then he went to sea. Traveled around the world. He was in Turkey. He came to America. He's a sailor, Frank Brangwyn. I saw this in Cleveland, and I thought to myself immediately, as perhaps you have, that this was William Morris, you know. And it's not Morris, but it's one of Morris's students. Then let's look at the next one. This is the other half, or a portion of the other half of that same lunette. See, in America, Magna Carta is part of the courthouses. It's carved in stone, that chapter 39. It's carved in granite. You can't walk in. Because they wanted to make it seem like eternal back in that era. And here, this other half is just the workers. It's just the commoners that he's depicting. And this is a man pushing off on a punt. And I'm sure there are many of you here who can tell me more about the meaning of it. But to get to, you know, where that part of the Thames and Runnymede, he believed everybody had to get there on water, you know. And so they'd have this ferryman push them off. But it reminded me that we were not the first person to begin looking at Magna Carta from the viewpoint of workers. And that Magna Carta was necessary for us, could help us as we try to reconstitute society. Thanks, Rich. Magna Carta in America has its cultural meanings. And so we went all over the Midwest and would have gone elsewhere to find pictures of different meanings of Magna Carta in courthouses. We went to Terre Haute, Indiana. Terre Haute, you might know, is a place where the federal penitentiary, that's the main place, the main source of employment. But it's also where Eugene Debs was born. Eugene Debs was the socialist in the early 20th century, ran for president, was almost a cellmate of Marcus Garvey's. They were in Atlanta at the same time. But he was born there. We went to his house, went into his... But the courthouse in Terre Haute also has a triptych of Magna Carta, and we took pictures of that and so on. But when I call people up to say, where is the Magna Carta murals? And they say, oh, you must mean the mural at the Jefferson Middle School. I said, oh, yeah? What's that about? Oh, I don't know, but it's beautiful. Everybody likes it. So we went down Washington Street, you know, to the Jefferson Middle School, hoping to find a Magna Carta mural. And instead, we find this. 1936. Gilbert White, an artist in Indiana. He does it in chalk. 1936, there's a general strike in Terre Haute for Social Security. And we have the four races of America as they imagined things back in the 1930s. yellow, red, black, white, as Boy Scouts over there holding hands. But in 1936, they're transformed into soldiers on the class war against these patriotic capitalists with their diamond pins.
And green faces.
And green faces. What do you think that is?
Greed.
Greed, yes.
Jealousy.
Greed, envy, jealousy.
Green with envy.
Green with envy, yeah. So this, we're really happy, you know, to find here in the middle of America such an affirmation of class war. Because what I knew about class war came from England and came from the tremendous class warriors of this country. I mean, that's not quite true. I'm just,
you know. Romanticizing.
Yeah, romanticizing. But I love romance. You know, I do. I really do. And you look in, maybe that's a problem, but you look into the romantic poets, and, you know, they were up against enclosures. Mm. Many different kinds of enclosures, including the enclosures of the mind, enclosures of the body, enclosures of land. And they were against the fences, to the romantic poets. And so am I. So that's